to the Torah Podcast. Today on the podcast, we have Carrie Wilkie. Carrie,
welcome. Hey, Jose. Thanks.
And so I brought you on the podcast because, one, I admire you. You're a wildlife photographer. You're learning to fly planes. You're just like amazing person overall, great leader from previous job that you had.
Thank you.
And you went on to follow your dreams and make your hobby a job.
Yeah.
So let's get into it.
Big scary move.
How's that going, by the way?
It's going great. This was the end of week five. Nice. So took my passion for wildlife and travel and photography and threw away the corporate job and walked out of the C-suite and joined a travel company. So working for a tour operator, helping others build their dream trips and travel of a lifetime.
Awesome.
Yeah.
How did this whole wildlife photography get started for you?
So the wildlife photography was a little bit of a curveball. I've always been into wildlife. I say my kind of crazy wildlife obsession happened when I was 10 years old. My parents took me to a traveling exhibit of giant pandas that went to like 10 different zoos in the U.S. The Toledo Zoo was about an hour from where I grew up, and that was one of the stops. So we went to the Toledo Zoo. I became a panda nut and collected all things pandas and did all things pandas. And then in 2017, kind of had that bucket list trip moment and went to China, volunteered in 3 panda reserves, spent a week hiking in the Min Mountain Range trying to find pandas in the wild. Did not happen. And before I took that trip, I was like, I should probably get a camera and like actually learn something about photography because I'm never going to do this again. And most people won't be able to do this. So these memories, you know, should be in something other than my head and in a way I can share it. So I got a Nikon like basic starter kit, you know, the 55 to 200 lens that comes stock kit with a Nikon camera. Literally learned how to use it on the trip. One of the guides was a photographer and was teaching me how to use it. And I came home and I was like, I got some pretty good shots. I mean, granted, it's panda reserves, so they're in enclosures and things like that, but got some pretty good shots. And in kind of using the photos to help people like know what I experienced and what that trip was, it really started to spark more of an interest with other people. And that's kind of when I realized, one, I want to see more wildlife. I want to see wildlife in the wild where it belongs while it's still there. And that probably isn't going to be very many years that some of these species are still in the wild. But two, photography is a great way to really tell that story and to get people interested and to really make it real for people in a way that telling the story can't.
Yeah. And so what are some of the trips that you took? I know, like, working with you over the years, you always kind of like at the lunchroom, like heard the wild, crazy stories. But, you know, let's walk over to like, what was your next trip? And what was the experience there where you actually got to see the animals in the wild?
Yeah, my goal has been big cats and bears. So seeing all the big cats and all the bears in the wild. So my next trip after the pandas, I celebrated my 40th birthday with a gift to myself of an African safari in Botswana. Ended up kind of making that a bigger trip than originally anticipated. I had a college friend who was from South Africa and kind of sang the praises. And so spent a few days in Cape Town, went to Zambia and Zimbabwe and hiked Bick Falls, and then went on to safari for 10 days in Botswana. Pro tip, when you can kind of combine holidays, I did this all over Christmas and New Year's, so it kind of hurts the PTO bank a little bit less doing that. So did the big African safari in Botswana, you know, saw the big five in the first 10 minutes that we were out on a safari drive, and had a really just magical experience on Christmas Day with a lion who just was like, he looked like he had just come from the salon with a blowout. He had the most phenomenal mane and just kind of put on a show for us. So I've done the safari in Botswana. I've also safaried in Tanzania. I've seen grizzly bears in Alaska, polar bears in Churchill, Canada. Been lucky to go to India 3 times for tigers and snow leopards both. And luckily, you know, fingers crossed, toes crossed, everything else. Every time I've gone on a wildlife trip, I've seen what we set out to see. And I think the most memorable probably was in Brazil and the Pantanal. They have a big 5 of the Pantanal. And nobody really talks about it because it's pretty impossible.
Let's back up a little bit. What is the big 5 in a safari?
So the big 5 in safari, and really it's a term that you're not supposed to use anymore because the big 5 came from the animal hunting days. And so it's the 5 things on an African safari that were the most dangerous to hunt on foot. So it's lion, leopard, elephant, rhino, Cape buffalo. So that's the big 5 on safari. Depending on where you go in Africa, generally fairly easy to see the big 5 in East and South Africa. So depending on kind of what you want to see, what you're setting out for, that kind of decides where you should go. In the Pantanal of Brazil, there's a big 5 that they have in the Pantanal in Brazil. It's jaguars, ocelots, giant river otters, giant anteater, and the 5th one is now escaping me. It'll come to me as we talk, I'm sure. But they tell you not to plan on the big 5 in the Pantanal because a lot of people go to the Pantanal to see jaguars. And so they go to the river areas. The giant anteaters aren't in the river areas, so you're just never going to get the big 5. Ocelots, you get on night drives. They're really, really, really hard to spot. So it's just one of those things. Don't get your hopes up to see that. I was lucky we did the entire Transpantanal and the Pantanal and then went to the southern part of the Pantanal. And we saw the big 5 at the Pantanal. So it's just, you know, one of those things that you kind of look at different wildlife and you're like, yeah, they're really, really hard to see. But maybe one day I'll be lucky enough to go on enough trips that I see them. And it's just really, I believe it's the energy that you put out there, that the animals just kind of understand your energy and understand where you're coming from.
This wasn't the first time that you got lucky. I remember the story of the snow leopards.
Oh, yeah. My first snow leopard trip was a kind of arduous hike into camp. It was a couple miles with a pretty big elevation gain. We were in the Himalayas in India. I was not in shape for that trip at all. And so it was a bit of a difficult hike into camp. There were 5 of us. We got to camp and I think everybody had a little bit of a shell shock to what are we doing. We were in tents. They were very nice tents, but they were tents. It was not running water. We were out for 7-8 days. And we got into the little dining hall tent and everybody kind of dropped their bags and was getting their wits back around them. And the spotters were outside on scopes and started yelling. And we all went outside and there was a mother and 2 cubs on the ridge overlooking camp just as the sun was going down. And it was just exhilarating and incredible. And we went on to have snow leopard sightings every day. We had 9 snow leopard sightings while we were there. And the second snow leopard trip I did, we also had sightings every day except one, which it's just seeing a snow leopard in the wild. If anybody has seen the movie Walter Mitty, which I haven't, I've only seen the one scene from Walter Mitty. I mean, that it sums it up so well. There are moments that are just for you that aren't for anybody else. I think just the majesty of where you are in the Himalayas, what it takes to get there, kind of the mental and physical and emotional fortitude you have to do it. And then to see a snow leopard in the wild and have that experience in such an insanely otherworldly place is just absolutely incredible.
This is amazing. And how do you balance? Because this, you know, started out as a hobby, right? And you know, just like any of us that get into hobbies, you see this room right here, right? Like it grows and grows with gear and different stuff. How has your gear, you know, transformed over the years? And what do you feel like you need versus like, oh, I really want that, right?
Yeah. My gear has gotten more expensive. not just the photography gear, like the regular gear too. I joke. I went to Chile to Patagonia to see pumas, and the tour leader, we got to the airport in Sao Paulo in Chile, And he was like, oh, are we stopping at the outfitter to get you clothes to take out? It was winter. Mm-hmm. And he's like, I missed the message that we needed to stop at the outfitter that you were renting cold weather gear. And I was like, I'm not. Why? And he's like, how do you just have that little tiny bag? I'm like, because bags are heavy and I don't like to check them. And so, you know, your clothing gear for wearing lots of layers gets more expensive as you have things that you want to be like super lightweight, but that are also going to keep you warm, keep you dry, things like that. Yeah. So, you know, there's definitely that part of where am I going in the world? What are the temperature conditions? Am I going to kind of be in these temperature conditions again? What do I want to invest in having gear that makes me, that I know I'm going to be comfortable, especially with photography where you may be just in one place for hours in whatever the conditions are. In Brazil, everybody was joking, calling me the invisible man. I look at the sun and I get a sunburn. So I, you know, it was 110 degrees. I was covered head to toe. I had gloves on. I mean, every part of me was covered because we were in an open metal boat on the water. Like, there was no question I was going to get fried. Yeah. I was hot, but I was not going to get sunburnt. So that side of the travel and photography is definitely, you know, invest in quality gear. Don't just get the cheap stuff. Once. Exactly. On the photography side, I think the interesting thing on the photography side is I've actually kind of whittled down. And again, that's in the stuff is heavy. A lot of these places you go, you're getting there by like bush planes and like crazy ways of getting places. The weight restrictions on those types of planes are real. It is not uncommon on an African safari to have a 25 or 30 pound weight restriction on all of your luggage. So if you're going to be on an African safari for 2 or 3 weeks and everything that you can take with you can't weigh more than 30 pounds, my fully loaded camera kit is close to 35. So then you start juggling, okay, am I going to pay extra? Like, am I going to get a freight luggage allowance so that I can pay extra and take everything? Or am I really going to get creative with what I take? So the big lesson I've learned over time is take a lens that's appropriate to the distance that you're shooting. You know, snow leopards having one of the great big huge monster lenses and a tripod and everything else is really a necessity. Having that great big huge lens on an African safari, you're never going to use it because it's just too much lens. The wildlife gets too close to you and you're not going to be able to get a shot with it. So don't bother taking it with you. I think the biggest thing that was kind of the photography investment to me was having two camera bodies so that you're not trying to swap out lenses. So if you've got an opportunity for kind of a macro, super up close shot, you've just got a camera body with a lens that you can grab and you're swapping out the bodies that are already fitted with a lens instead of trying to swap out lenses. Because I will also say the dust is no joke on those trips. So you really don't want to be taking lenses on and off in a vehicle.
That is great. So that's where the like $40 socks come in handy.
The $40 socks come in handy. I will say in the Himalayas, the $100 like mountaineering socks. Yeah. But the other, you know, pro tip there, if you do one of those trips is put those on with your boots because they make your feet a whole lot bigger than the normal socks. So those are the things that you need to know. And then just really having, you know, the right gear and the right equipment for when you're back at camp, like understanding what's the charging situation. Do you have power all the time? Are you on generators? Are you on solar? Like, do you have charging points in your tent or in the lodge that you're staying in? Or are the charging points all maybe in the dining hall? And, you know, it's never a bad idea to have a power strip with you when you're traveling and all of those things.
That's great. Yeah. Yeah. Cause we do some camping, right? Like they're mostly car camping here and there, but there are times where we do hikes and, you know, backpacking and stuff like that. And the first time we ever went camping, I was like, well, I'll take a blanket and a pillow and this and that. And then I'm carrying all this stuff, even, you know, like a couple miles. And I'm like, oh my God, this is horrible right now. And then you learn and then you adjust. And, and so I guess it was the same thing, just on the different
level. Exactly. Exactly. And you see it, you know, especially on African safaris, you see it a lot because you can pay a lot of money for an African safari and you can go everywhere from, you know, fly camping with a tent on the ground to some crazy high-end luxury areas and camps and lodges. And a lot of times a high-end luxury traveler doesn't want to be told, like, no, you can't take all of your makeup and all of your hair stuff and a change of clothes three times a day and all of those things. And so you get to a camp and you're like, wait a minute, like I complied with this 30-pound weight limit and I've got a duffel bag that I carried on my back for like the last 22 hours of travel and these people have framed suitcases. And then you're out on the airstrip waiting for the bush planes and you're watching their suitcases get left behind because there's no space on the plane. So they'll get it eventually, but you know, pro tip, you need like three outfits for a safari. For 2 weeks, you need like three outfits because there's laundry everywhere. You can do laundry in your room. Stuff dries really fast when it's hot outside.
So merino wool.
Exactly. Like that, you just, and you learn, like, am I going to look super cute for the next 2 weeks? No. But do I need to? No. The animals don't care.
That's great. Can you share the story of the elephants? Like swimming with the elephants?
Oh, gosh. Yeah. So, my first tiger safari to India, the last area we went to was Kaziranga, which is in the north of India, near Nepal. It's most famously known for tea. That's where the tea plantations are in India. But it's a very different terrain than central India, where we had spent the rest of the trip. And there are Asian elephants in Kaziranga. And Kaziranga is famous for rhinos. And so it's where you go if you want to go to India to see rhinos, you go to Kaziranga. And we had the opportunity to do a game drive one morning on domestic elephants, which I know there's controversy around domesticated elephants. Not going to get in that part of it on this podcast, but we took the opportunity to go out with the elephants. Really incredible. It was at sunrise. And so, you know, we were up over the rhinos as they were getting up for the day and wildlife that was bedded down. And it was just a really unique perspective. But we got back to camp and the mahout asked if we wanted to give one of the elephants her bath because she was done working for the day. And at the end of their working shift, they get a bath. And I'm like, heck yeah, sign me up for that.
Yeah.
And so they're like, go change into something that you don't care if it gets wet and muddy and messy. It was the last day of our trip. We were flying back to the States the next day. So I had plenty of dirty clothes. And so went and changed and came down and I don't know why it hadn't quite clicked with me yet. You know, we were in a camp on a river. We were in India. In my head, though, like, I grew up on farms. Yeah, I'm like, there's got to be, like, a big barn that we're just not seeing with hoses and brushes and things like that. So we come down to the meeting point, and the mahout is in the river with the elephant. And showing us how to make scrub brushes out of, like, reed grasses and tie them together and everything. And I'm just standing there thinking, am I really going to get in the Brahmaputra River in India to give an elephant a bath? And I'm like, yeah, I am. Like, I've had all my shots, and I'm going to do this. I'm just going to hope there's nothing else in the water that I don't want to be there, and nothing's crawling under my toenails. Yeah. Probably the next moment of panic that I had, two steps into the water and sank to my knees in mud. And that was just kind of the, all right, there is definitely other stuff in this water, and I'm just going to go with it. And we gave the elephant her bath, and it was just a really, really incredible experience. Probably will never do it again in my lifetime. That was 2018, and I'm still here to tell the story, and I don't think there was anything crawling under my toenails when it happened, or if there was, it hasn't gotten me yet.
Yeah, so. Either that or it has good benefits.
Exactly. Exactly.
My older son is obsessed with bears.
Okay.
And I was scrolling through your Instagram and showing him the shots of bears that you got. And you got some really cool, like, close-up shots. Where was those?
The grizzly bears were in Katmai National Park in Alaska. And I joke that it took the pandemic to get me to finally go to Alaska. I was kind of on a pace of two of these off the beaten path, off the grid trips per year. In 2019, between work and personal, I flew almost 200,000 miles. I was gone the entire month of February 2020, and I came home to the world shutting down.
Yeah.
And it really, that really got to me. And I struggled with it just in the sense of, like, my life as far as having an income, having a job, having a roof over my head, being able to pay for groceries didn't change. And for a lot of people, it changed dramatically. So it felt kind of trite to say that my life was upside down. But going from, you know, that kind of travel and being on the go to being at home for months was a big change for me. So 2021, I was really keen to start traveling again. The world was really still pretty locked down. And a good friend of mine got his start guiding in Alaska, guiding bears, a guy named Brad Josephs. He's amazing. If anybody wants to do anything grizzly bear related, he's guiding now in northern India doing Himalayan brown bears. He was like, when are you finally going to come to Alaska? And I was like, Alaska's open for U.S. travelers. I'm there. So I went in July of 2021 to Katmai. We stayed in a boat out in Katmai Bay. So flew into Kodiak, took a float plane out to a boat in Katmai Bay. Katmai National Park is a non-motorized park, so you can't have any vehicles in Katmai. I think we saw about four or five other people the whole time we were there, three of whom were park rangers that were doing a walking assessment of the park. But we were just surrounded by grizzly bears. And the one thing that was good for wildlife in COVID was there was a huge baby boom in wildlife, and a lot of it likely was because the animals weren't stressed anywhere. There, you know, there weren't planes overhead. There weren't tourists. The pollution rates globally went down because of, you know, no one was traveling. And so animals just really were very prolific in places that people could travel in 21 and kind of early 22. And so we spent 10 days just surrounded by grizzly bears, and it was absolute magic. We were on the opposite side of Katmai National Park from Brooks Falls, which most people know Brooks Falls for the fat bears, and where people go to watch the bears in the river catching the salmon. We were on the opposite side of Katmai. Most of our time was in an area called Halo Bay, and there was a massive baby boom in Halo Bay. So we had two sows that each had three first summer cubs. So they were cubs that had been born that spring. So they were pretty little. And we had two sows that had three second summer cubs each. So those were cubs that were a little over a year old. And it just absolutely incredible experience. We would go from the boat that we were staying on. We would get in a tender. They would take us up to a sandbar every day. We were wearing chest waders and boots. And so we'd jump out of the boat on the sandbar and walk across to the beach and then just kind of walk. And Brad's little secret for bear viewing is to get on their level. And so we all carried 5-gallon paint buckets that we would sit on. And so we would be walking from the boat to the shore with our paint buckets and just pick a place that we thought looked like a good chill place and flip our buckets and sit down and get our camera gear ready. And within minutes, the bears would just come and just kind of flock to
What's
us.
What's the distance?
So in the parks, any time you're wildlife viewing, there are rules, whether it's, you know, the park or the reserve or the country that you're in, there are rules about how close you can get to the wildlife. In Katmai, I think the rule is 500 yards that you have to maintain between you and the bear. That said, if the bears come closer to you, you are not required to move. And everybody always asks, you know, how many guns we had, everything. We had a flare. We did not have a gun. I've two trips in my life. We've had guns in Kaziranga. The ranger had a gun, and that was for poachers because there are so many rhinos there.
Yeah.
And one day in Botswana, we did a walking safari. So we had a gun because we were on foot in an area where the big five are. But we did not have a gun with the bears. Mm-hmm. We had experiences where the bears got quite a bit closer to us. We had a one of the mothers that had the three first summer cubs. They had actually been filming. Brad had had a group out there filming a documentary most of the summer or most of the spring. And so she was pretty used to him being around and pretty chill. And she often would come and nurse her cubs in front of us, which is just very much a sign that they're relaxed. And she seemed like she was proud of her cubs and she wanted to show them off. And the cubs would, you know, chase each other and play. They're baby animals. Yeah. And the one cub was, I think he's a little naughty. He just would like come a little closer and a little closer and a little closer. And one day, finally, he was probably 8 or 10 feet from me. And I was just like, it's not a safe situation for the bear. Mm-hmm. And I'm willing to push things a lot, but when it's no longer a safe situation for the animal, that's, you know, when the limits come in. And so I was like, it's not a safe situation for the bear. And if the mother decided that she wasn't cool with this anymore, then it's just not a safe situation for any of us. And so the kind of the first encounter with a bear, if you're just trying to assert dominance, you just talk to them. So just in a normal tone of voice, you don't have to get big yet or get loud yet or anything. And just in this tone of voice, I said, "You don't come this close to people, silly bear." And he like jumped back and was like, "Oh my gosh, what was that? It made a noise that I don't know." And he kind of ran back closer to the mom, and the mom raised her head and kind of looked around, and she was just like, "Yeah, whatever," and went back to just grazing. So I think she knew she had free babysitting.
I think also what I was reading is that because they feed a lot, they have plenty of food. They don't have to.
Yeah. And that's the thing, understanding your environment, understanding where you are. So the bears in Katmai, it's a non-motorized park. The area we were in is little visited, so there aren't a lot of threats to the bears. The bears in that area are an apex predator. If anything, the mother is more worried about a male bear coming into the territory because they'll kill the cubs. Yeah. It'll be infanticide. And so understanding that in that environment, you can probably let things go a little bit longer with bears than definitely in an environment like around here where you might see a black bear, where, you know, they're fighting for territory, they're fighting for food, they're much more likely to be aggressive. The same was true in Patagonia with the pumas. I joked, we were out, you know, we were 6 days, I think, hiking with pumas. I was laying on the ground next to a puma that had two older cubs. They were on a kill. And so we were laying on the ground taking photos. It was a puma that our tracker knew really, really well. She's pretty famous in the area. And so the guides and the trackers know her well, know her temperament really well. She got up from feeding and, you know, did the big stretch and walked right past me. I mean, I could have reached out and touched her. The same would not be true of pumas in California. In Patagonia, pumas are the apex predator. There's tons of guanaco. They don't have to fight hard to eat. They don't have to fight hard for territory. There's so much protected space. And so they just are really chill because they don't have the same threats. Whereas, you know, you read people get attacked on a trail in California just for coming around a bend, and all of a sudden, you know, there's a mountain lion and it stalks them or attacks. They're fighting for territory. They're fighting for food. They're not habituated. They don't have that same sense of this is my territory and you're in it versus this is a territory we're fighting over. So you really have to know where you are to understand kind of how you can have an experience with the wildlife.
Has there ever been a close call at all where you, besides, you know, what's in the river?
So we got charged by an elephant in Botswana. We were fine. It was we were having sundowners one evening. So African safaris, it's pretty common that to wrap up your afternoon safari, your guide or your driver will find a really great spot where you can have a cocktail and watch the sunset. And so they put out a little spread on the hood of the Jeep and make cocktails and have snacks. And you watch the sunset and get out and stretch your legs. And then you make your way back to camp to get cleaned up for dinner. There was a female elephant kind of off in the distance, just grazing and super chill. And the guide that we had asked if I wanted to go over and take some photos of the elephant laying on the ground. So just different perspective. And she was still off pretty well into the distance. But we were in an area, there weren't any hippos around, there wasn't anything else that we were seeing. So went over and laid down on the ground to get some different perspective shots. And I don't know if she noticed us or if something else set her off or what it was, but she looked up and she kind of looked around. And you could just kind of sense that something in the air shifted. And then she looked up again and she raised her ears. And so we were like, okay, we need to move. And then she started flapping her ears. And when an elephant starts flapping their ears, you need to get out of the way because that's a charge signal. But you can't just like pop up and run because that will definitely set them off. So we had to crab walk because we didn't want to lose sight of where she was if she started to charge. But we needed to get out of the situation and kind of do it quickly, but not too aggressively. So we kind of crab walked for a little bit and then kind of got up and crouched and kind of walked in a squat. So that, you know, I've had a couple of instances where it could have been a close call. We had a similar situation with a rhino in Kaziranga. I had a, I call it my mind meld moment with a lion in Tanzania, who just decided, like, we locked eyes and he came straight for our Jeep. And the driver wanted to leave. And I was like, no, we don't need to leave. We're fine. But he, the lion got so close to the Jeep that all you could see was the tip of his tail because he was right up next to the Jeep. So I have had a couple of instances where I think other people that were traveling with us were more nervous than I was. But it's, you know, some of it's in the how far are you willing to push it a little bit to have that experience.
I remember in Hawaii, we were going to go scuba diving, sea turtles or something. And my wife is like, there's not going to be sharks, are there? And the tour guide's like, yeah, there's going to be reef sharks, but they're small, you know, they're, you know. And she's like, oh, no, I don't like that so much, you know, this and that. And this little girl, she was like, don't worry. They're, you know, they don't like the iron in our blood. So if they bite you, they're going to let it go because you're kind of disgusting to them. And she's like, well, I don't want it to get to the point that they bite me. Right. So
I don't want to find out firsthand that they don't like the iron in our blood.
But we did see some white tips, you know, sharks and the reefs and all that stuff. And, you know, again, they have plenty of food. They usually feed at night. So it's not something that to worry about, you know. Yeah. And they're pretty small. But yeah. And that day, there was another group that went a little bit further out and they saw a whale shark.
Okay.
And they got, like, really close to it and all that stuff. That was us. So for me, it's like, you know, I love the going into the sea and seeing wildlife there. We've done a bunch of these trips. Not enough for me to get, like, a scuba license and go that type. But, you know, enough for, I like, you know, seeing that. And I like the peaceful, tranquil of, like, the sea.
Yeah. I haven't done a lot of water-based adventures. So I don't know why. I don't have a fear of the water. But my focus has really been cats and bears. And I've seen the major species of big cats in the wild. There are subspecies that I haven't seen in the wild. And so now I'm like, I think I want to move on to small cats. And small cats are just notoriously a lot harder to spot and also require, in a lot of instances, going like deeper into jungles and things. And I have a complete irrational fear of snakes. So I'm like, where do I start to balance out the fear of snakes with the wanting to go in a jungle and find small cats?
So you also started to learn how to fly.
Yeah.
How's that going?
Well, it would be going better if the weather would cooperate. So my last four lessons have been canceled because of wind and rain. So as of right now, I have a lesson tomorrow afternoon. So crossing my fingers that actually stays on the books. We'll see what the weather does tomorrow.
Can you speak into why you got started with this?
Yeah. So that is kind of a long journey coming. When I was in Botswana, we were in three different areas of Botswana. I was there during their rainy season in December and January. And it's also called the green season. And so you just get these lush, vibrant green grasses and trees in the middle of the African desert that you wouldn't expect to see there when you're there in the green season. But you get these wicked thunderstorms that pop up in the afternoons. One of those afternoons, we were transferring camps and going into the central Kalahari Desert. And so the bush pilot got there. We were leaving the Okavango Delta, and the skies had just been getting darker and darker, and it was really windy. And so the bush pilot got there, and he's like, we're going to go. It's going to be kind of a wicked ride. We'll be fine. Like, we're used to this, but just everybody be prepared. And he asked me if I wanted to sit co-pilot. He asked if I wanted to sit up front. I'm like, yeah, sure. And so we were going through these crazy storms. The radar in the plane was purple. I've never seen a purple radar before. He's, you know, taking photos of the radar, taking photos out the windows. And we landed and I asked him, I said, why the pictures? And he's like, because I have to justify for the company the extra fuel we used because I was trying to get around some of the storm cells. So, I mean, he's driving this plane like it's a video game. Like, it's like the Grand Theft Auto version of like driving a piloting an airplane. And we got on the ground and I was just like, I want to learn how to do this. That was 2018. I've talked about it a lot. I talked about it again during COVID and just never did it. And so this past year for my birthday, my parents actually said that they wanted to get me gifts instead of cash or a gift card for something. And I said, get me flying lessons. And to which my mom replied, I can't support you having two hobbies that scare me. And I said, well, my one hobby that scares you is about to become my job. So it would still just be one hobby that scares you. But she said no to that. But my boyfriend got me an intro with three lessons. And I took the first lesson and I was like, yeah, I want to do this. So it's a ton of fun. I'm learning on a Piper Warrior over in Robbinsville, New Jersey, a great little flight school over there. And I think I'm about 7 hours in. So not very far in because, like I said, the weather won't cooperate. But it's a lot of fun.
Yeah, I told you this, but basically I had the same experience where my wife gave me, you know, the flying lessons before. It was right when we had the kids.
Okay.
So the first one. And she got me the flying lessons. We went out. It was Trenton Airport. And it was Groupon too. I remember you, which is like, I've done my research. This is it, right?
Yeah. He was torn between wanting to say, I want to make sure this is safe, and also, if you get your pilot's license, you're going to want me to fly with you at some point. Mm-hmm. So I need to know I'm safe. So he's like, Groupon might seem shady, but it's okay.
Yeah. So we get there, we go in the airplane, all the stuff. My wife sits in the back, and she just falls asleep because this is just like maybe months, like a couple months after, because kid was born in May, July is my birthday. Yep. So yeah, a couple months after, you know, we had the kid and she falls asleep and the pilot just goes, she must really trust you.
She didn't think you would actually be flying in that first lesson. I think that's the key. Like, I mean, she was exhausted.
No, she knew.
But she was probably like, like the safety net is there. So like nothing bad is going to happen here.
But he was like, she must really. He's like, I see this a lot with like couples come and the partner sits in back and it's usually like white knuckling the back of my seat the whole time. And it's like, and I was like, no, we just had a baby and she's exhausted. And probably just this is a good time to sleep.
I in my lesson where we were learning steep turns, the instructor, you know, would demonstrate and then talk me through it. And he was like, if you start to not feel well, just tell me right away. Like, we can go into this a little more gradually. It's totally common for people to not feel well. And he knows, like, I've flown in crazy bush planes and helicopters and all sorts of things. And so I was like, okay, no problem. And so he did the demo one and he's like, you feeling okay? And I'm like, yeah. And he's like, okay, I'll do the other side and then I'll have you do it. And so he did a second one and then he's like, all right, go for it. You know, get us to 60 degrees, do the full circle. And we finished the first one and he looked over at me and he's like, I can confidently say no one has ever been laughing while they've done that before. I'm like, it was fun. What can I tell you?
So what are some of the next trips that you want to take personally or like for work that you're excited to looking forward to?
Yeah. So I had a trip planned for this fall that I actually have to move around because we have a friend's wedding, but I was going to head back to the Pantanal to see the Jaguars again, go a little bit later in the season and deal with some harsher temperatures so that we could get some better sightings. But that'll get rescheduled at some point. I've decided kind of so. Thanksgiving of last year, we just went away for a week to Panama, not wildlife related, but went to Panama to have a little getaway in some nicer weather. And that was country 40 for me. And so I said I didn't hit 40 by 40, but I'm on a new goal to hit 50 by 50. So I have 10 countries to go in the next 4 years. So that's a little bit of a goal of mine is hitting some more countries. They may not all be wildlife focused, but hitting some more countries. Always looking at somewhere new to go. I will say job hazard right now, 5 weeks in, is helping people plan trips and seeing these itineraries. And I'm like, oh, I want to do that. 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 I'm really intrigued right now by Namibia. I'm learning a lot more about Namibia. That is like an up and coming hot spot that people are going to and some pretty cool desert adapted lions that are on the Skeleton Coast of Namibia. So some what look like amazing experiences in Namibia, some parts of Namibia that don't have predators at all, apex predators at all. So you can do sleep under the stars and things like that safely, which look pretty cool. In the process right now of working with one of our conservation partners, Wildlife Madagascar, to put together some exploratory trips to Madagascar. So lemurs are not really my thing, but I wouldn't say no to exploring Madagascar. It seems like a pretty cool country. About 7,000 Americans a year visit Madagascar, so it's pretty undiscovered. I will say it takes about 30 hours of travel to get there. So it is, it's not an easy place to reach, but it's, it seems to be a pretty interesting island that has a lot of different potential to explore.
My wife works with a guy who is from Madagascar.
Okay.
And my wife's like, wow, that's cool. How's that like? You know, and he's like, well, you've seen the cartoon. Yeah, it's pretty, it's like that. Yeah. But, 40 under 40, that'll be a cool goal for me, I guess.
Yeah,
I guess.
You've done a lot of travel.
I've done a lot of travel, but, you know, in the next 3 years, if I can do 20 more, you know, or 17 more, I should say.
Yeah. There are some places that are easier to get to and some places that are more reasonable. I took the path of no kids. So, you know, being able to drop everything and spend
this year,
a weekend
we're doing
away
three.
Is, okay.
So we're going to UK next week and Italy after that, and then Peru in August.
Oh, very nice.
So
fun.
We can knock him down.
Yeah, there you go. I'll be curious to hear about Peru. I was just talking to somebody the other day, and he was like, you've been to Peru? And I was like, no, I haven't. He's like, how have you not been to Peru? I'm like, big cats and bears. That's what I've been focused on.
Like a impromptu trip.
Okay.
It was like, we have the points. We don't want it to go to waste. And my wife was like, we can go there really cheaply. Let's go for my birthday.
Oh, very
and,
fun.
And I was like, yeah, let's do it. And she was like, and the place where we want to stay, it's like in Lima, but there's like a jiu-jitsu school nearby.
Okay.
And she was like, you can train. And I was like, then we should be going. I don't know why.
Why didn't we do this before?
And she knows me. Like, it's like, oh, let me dangle this in front of him.
Exactly.
And fire another country at.
That's awesome.
My wife has always been great at like finding great deals. And we do a lot of traveling, not quite like yours, but they're more touristy and we're not very much like, you know, we might check the box on going to see the Louvre, but, you know, it's not our attraction.
Yeah.
It's more of like the countryside, the mountains, the, you know, small little villages and all that stuff. That's what we love. And she finds amazing, amazing deals that I don't know how she does it. I don't know what, you know, kind of strings she pulls, but I remember there was a year when we did not have a lot of money. And I'm like, honey, like traveling, I don't know if we are going to be able to do vacations this year. And she's like, well, how much is the budget? And she found this like 5-star hotel in Cabo for like $2,000 for the whole family, all inclusive. And when we got there, the hotel was like, how'd you get this for two? This is like $1,800 a night for this room. And you found it for the whole week?
Well, those are also, I mean, just like some travel tips to have is, you know, if you're willing to go places off peak season, or like if you're willing to go places that don't include a weekend in your stay, I mean, there are ways to do it. You don't have to fly a discount airline and, you know, sit on the wing or anything like that. But there are definitely ways to go have some amazing experiences, and especially going places off peak season, not having hordes of tourists. I did that for Greece. I went to Greece at the end of October one year, and everybody was like, nothing will be open.
Yeah.
And I was like, I don't care if anything's open or not. Like the places that you want to go, the Acropolis and the Parthenon and all of that stuff will be open. But there weren't tourists because there weren't school holidays yet. The school, like the European schools that go to Greece for field trips and school trips and stuff, they weren't really doing it yet because they were just back to school. So, I mean, the biggest thing you ran into is like the cruises were all old people. So as long as you got ahead of the old people and didn't look, because, oh my gosh, that was also at the Acropolis. If you've been, like, it's stone and marble that you're walking on, and it is slippery. And so I'm there, there's like this whole tour group of people in their 70s and 80s, and people are falling left and right. And I'm like, I just can't watch. Like, it's just like this whole like old folks tour group is going to end up needing hip replacements at the end of this trip.
I remember in Puerto Rico, we went to Vieques. We took like a small little plane to Vieques, which is a smaller island in Puerto Rico. And it was like right at the beginning of the school year. So the kids missed like a couple days.
Yeah.
Whatever. What? And there was nobody there.
Yep.
And every single beach we went to, it was like our own little private beach.
Yeah.
And it was like amazing. And you have the wild horses running around.
Yeah.
And it was just a
great, you might sacrifice a restaurant or two that aren't open because it's off season or things like that. But yeah, you can get some amazing deals and get some great photos that aren't full of other people.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That is true.
Yeah, definitely.
Thank you so much for coming.
Yeah,
thank you so much for sharing with all of us like your stories. And you know, where can people find you? What's your Instagram handle?
Yeah, so my Instagram is Carrie Wildlife Travels, Carrie Wildlife Travels. You can find me there. It's got a link to my Smug Mug if you want to buy photos. But my Instagram is all my wildlife photos, and all my details are there professionally as well. If you're interested in travel, hit us up at Rewild Safaris, and we can help you put together a dream trip.
That's amazing. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you. Bye.